Good morning. May it please the court, Camilla Taylor for plaintiff's appellants. There are two main claims in this case, that the exclusion of lesbian and gay couples and their children from marriage violates both the due process clause and the equal protection guarantee. We say that we win both because it violates the fundamental right to marry and also because it discriminates based on sexual orientation, based on sex, and with respect to the exercise of a fundamental right. Now, the state and the court below reach a different result because they begin their analysis with two flawed premises. First, they argue that states have exclusive authority over marriage, regardless of what the equal protection and due process clauses dictate. And we know that that's not true. We know that's not true not only because of the Supreme Court cases that we cited to this court in our brief, including Turner versus Safley and Zablocki and Loving versus Virginia, but also because of this court's precedent in Kirchberg versus Feenstra, for example, in which this court struck down a marriage restriction in Louisiana law that designated husbands the head and master over community property. Even though that law enjoyed ancient historical roots, it dated back to before the time of the Louisiana Purchase, and the court struck it down because it violated the equal protection guarantee. We can learn from this that routine and familiar equal protection analysis applies, even when it's a marriage law that is subject to constitutional challenge. The second flawed premise of both the state and the court below is the state's claim that somehow the fact of a national debate concerning the exclusion of lesbian and gay couples and their children from marriage is itself a reason to preclude courts from constitutional review. We know that's not true either, because the equal protection guarantee is, at its essence, a counter-majoritarian principle. If it means anything at all, it means that courts are not only empowered, but obligated to strike down laws when those laws target a minority for disfavored treatment, even when those laws enjoy majority support and were passed through the democratic process. The Liberty Guarantee protects individuals from government intrusion into their autonomy, no matter whether government is acting with popular support. The court below described this case as a clash between what it termed a, quote, policy preference for the liberty and equality guarantees on the one hand, and between those who value state decisions reached by way of the democratic process. However, the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses are not policies that can be preferred. They're mandates. They're not optional. And even when states act in an area that is indisputably a matter of state rather than federal purview, states can't use the democratic process to write inequality into the law or to deprive individuals of the liberty and autonomy that's guaranteed by the Due Process Clause. And I think actually there are echoes.
Specifically, counsel, what liberty interests are you talking about?
Well, the fundamental right to marry, Your Honor, is one of the liberty interests that we describe. The fundamental right to marry protects all of us in our ability to choose the person we wish to marry. It protects the freedom of choice in the selection of one's spouse. And I think there are echoes here from the lower court's opinion in Kirchberg versus Feenstra, again, where the state argued that those marriage laws were insulated from review under the Equal Protection Clause because they were marriage laws. And the state wrote, the lower court wrote, the choice of a matrimonial property system is one best made on the state level by the people of Louisiana, and therefore that the equal protection and due process guarantees didn't apply. But this court reversed and was upheld by the Supreme Court. This court has also emphasized this principle again in SIF versus State Democratic Executive Committee, and it said, the Supreme Court has made clear on many occasions that matters guaranteed by the Bill of Rights are not to depend on majority vote. The state relies mostly on two cases, Schutte versus BAMN and Windsor, and it mischaracterizes both. First, with respect to Schutte. In Schutte, the Supreme Court expressly affirmed the principle, what it called the well-established principle, that when hurt or injury is inflicted on individuals by a law, the Constitution requires redress by the courts. The court concluded that the provision in Schuette, the referendum, did not inflict such hurt or injury because it removed race as a permissible consideration by government. By contrast, here, the law targets lesbian and gay people and their children for disfavored treatment, and I think it's evident that the Supreme Court would not have upheld a measure under Schuette that actually targeted people based on their race for exclusion from marriage laws. So Schuette itself supports constitutional review in this case. There's also no dispute in this case that the marriage ban in Louisiana harms lesbian and gay couples and their children. The state doesn't dispute it. The court below didn't dispute it. In fact, no court has ever disputed that there are harms here because these couples are denied numerous tangible benefits and protections, such as Social Security or family medical leave and the ability to shelter their children through marriage. But also, they're deprived of dignity and equality in a way that harms people to their very souls and their cores.
Counsel, you mentioned constitutional review. What level of review do you maintain applies in this case?
Strict scrutiny, Your Honor, because it infringes upon a fundamental right. At least heightened scrutiny because it discriminates with respect to sex and sexual orientation. But the key here is that it cannot survive any level
strict
of review.
Strict scrutiny.
Yes,
at
Your
least
Honor.
Heightened scrutiny. And even if rational basis review,
we still win,
you still
Your
win.
Honor. Yes, we do. Because it lacks even a rational connection to a legitimate governmental interest.
What do you do with our circuit case from 2004, Johnson versus Johnson, which established rational basis review?
Your Honor, in Johnson versus Johnson, this court struck down government action that targeted someone based on sexual orientation because there was not even a legitimate governmental interest to support that differential treatment. The court observed in that case that the Supreme Court had never accorded heightened scrutiny to classifications based on sexual orientation, but it didn't perform the traditional analysis of the factors that courts generally consider when determining whether to apply heightened scrutiny, and it certainly didn't preclude the application of heightened scrutiny in the future.
Well, it cited Romer and said that it was bound by Romer, and of course we are bound by another panel opinion of our court, so it seems to me that it's a recent precedent, a well-written opinion by Judge King, and that it deserves our usual deference.
In Romer, Your Honor, the same thing was true in that it was unnecessary to decide whether heightened scrutiny was appropriate because the measure that was challenged in Romer did not even meet the lowest level of scrutiny because there was not even a legitimate purpose to justify the law, and in fact, it served an illegitimate purpose. That same fact pattern is true in Johnson because the court actually struck down the differential treatment there. The traditional four-factor analysis.
Well, I understand that. Again, I'm giving it more of a process analysis than anything else. That is to say, whether or not Johnson was correctly decided, you recognize that we're bound by it.
I do, Your Honor. There are also two recent circuit court decisions. There are three federal circuit courts now that apply heightened scrutiny to classifications based on sexual orientation, and two have done so recently as a result of the Windsor decision, observing that what happened in Windsor was not rational basis analysis and that there were many aspects of that decision that warrant a more searching review of these classifications. Windsor did not accept any conceivable justification for the law. It looked at the degree of harm and intrusion that the law imposed on lesbian and gay couples and their children, and it also didn't give the law that was at issue in Windsor any sort of presumption of constitutionality. And so for that reason, the Seventh and the Ninth concluded that Windsor now means that heightened scrutiny is appropriate. But in any event, even under rational basis analysis, the two governmental interests that have been put forward by the state here simply fail as a matter of law. The state has argued first that the purpose of the exclusion of lesbian and gay couples from marriage in Louisiana serves the purpose of achieving social consensus through the democratic process. But this is not actually an independent legislative end at all. It's simply a description of the means by which laws are passed. And as Judge Higginbotham noted in the St. Joseph Abbey case, there needs to be an independent legislative end that is served by a law. It's not enough for the legislature to say, for example, that a business regulation serves the purpose of economic protectionism, because That's simply a description of favoritism. The law has to serve something independent that's germane to the general welfare or to the public interest. With respect to the second governmental interest that the state has put forward, which is linking biological or children to their biological parents, there's no logical nexus at all between that asserted purpose and the exclusion of lesbian and gay couples and their children from marriage. Banning Jackie and Lauren Brettner and their daughter from marriage helps no child whatsoever, not one, no one in Louisiana or anywhere else. Children who have biological links to their parents remain completely unaffected by whether lesbian and gay couples can marry. Further, the state of Louisiana actually allows lesbian and gay individuals to adopt, which makes it arbitrary in the extreme for courts to find that these families serve the best interests of the children at the heart of that case, and then to deny those same children the shelter of marriage that they would have if their parent could marry. There is simply no benefit whatsoever to any child from this exclusion, and the harms that Windsor identified to children are equally present here. These bans humiliate the children of same-sex couples, and as Windsor put it, they deprive these children of the ability to understand the integrity and the closeness of their own families and its concord with the community. That is the essence of this case, that these children are told that there is something wrong with them and their families, and government has no business doing that. Also, I'd like to note that the purpose and effect of the Louisiana marriage ban, the state has conceded. It was passed in the same context as the federal DOMA. Windsor tells us that the purpose and effect of DOMA was to disparage and to demean, and Windsor also tells us that it was passed in the wake of litigation in Hawaii in order to prevent same-sex couples who married in Hawaii from achieving federal recognition. The Louisiana marriage ban was passed also in the wake of litigation in Hawaii, and the state readily concedes this, in order to prevent recognition of marriages that same-sex couples might enter into in Hawaii and then return to Louisiana and seek respect for. Windsor also tells us that the purpose of denying respect to these families is improper. And I'd like to address just for a moment the lower court's mistaken conclusions about the doctrine of animus. First, animus was present here. It was a factor in the passage of Louisiana's marriage bans. But I need to be clear that a finding of animus is not necessary in order for us to win, even under the lowest level of review. Animus is one of the triggers for a court's careful consideration of the constitutionality of a law, although it's not the only trigger by any means. But the lower court misunderstood what animus means as a term of art in its constitutional sense. Animus doesn't mean bigotry or malice, or as the lower court put it, hatefulness. As Justice Kennedy's explained in Board of Alabama Trustees versus Garrett, for example, animus can take the form simply of a lack of understanding of people who appear different from ourselves and the instinct to protect against such difference. In fact, to give you more of that quote, he writes, "Prejudice, we are beginning to understand, rises not from malice or hostile animus alone. It may result as well from insensitivity caused by simple want of careful, rational reflection or from some instinctive mechanism to guard against people who appear to be different in some respects from ourselves." Certainly, that was present here. Courts have found the presence of animus in at least four ways. One, they found the presence of an impermissible purpose because of the breadth of the exclusion, and this is Romer and Windsor. Here, the breadth of the Louisiana marriage ban also justifies that inference because it deprives same-sex couples and their children not only of hundreds of state law rights and responsibilities, but also more than 1,000 on the federal level. They've also looked at the plain text of the provision. That's Windsor. In Windsor, the plain text, the title of the measure, Defense of Marriage Act, was found relevant to justify an inference of animus. That same title is the title of the 2004 constitutional amendment, Defense of Marriage. Three, they've looked at the context in which the law has passed. And as I've already discussed, that context is the same, namely the wake of litigation in Hawaii. And four, the absence of any connection to any legitimate purpose is itself a reason to find an inference of animus. and that is not only the Romer case, but also Cleburne and Moreno. That is certainly true here because there, as I've explained, there is absolutely no connection to any legitimate interest that is served by the marriage ban. I'd like to turn just for a moment to the fundamental right claim, unless the court has questions about anything else. The nature of the fundamental right at issue in this case is a protection for autonomy. And the two cases that I think are most relevant about this are Hodgson versus Minnesota and Roberts versus JC's, where the court in both cases speaks of freedom of choice in the selection of one's spouse as being the crux of the fundamental right to marry. And in Hodgson specifically, the court writes, the regulation of constitutionally protected decisions, such as where a person shall reside or whom he or she shall marry, must be predicated on legitimate state concerns other than disagreement with the choice the individual has made. The state tries to describe the fundamental right at issue here in an artificially narrow way as solely the right asserted to marry someone of the same sex. But that's the same error that the Supreme Court has rejected in other contexts. And in Lawrence, specifically, the court found that the way the fundamental right had been defined in the previous case, Bowers versus Hardwick, failed to appreciate the extent of the liberty interests at stake because the court in Bowers versus Hardwick had described it too narrowly by reference to the sex of the individuals who were seeking to exercise the right at issue in that case. When a person who has previously been excluded from exercise of a fundamental right steps forward and seeks to exercise that right, courts look to history and tradition in order to determine whether the nature of the autonomy sought is something that the Constitution has shielded in the past. So, for example, they would look in Glucksberg to whether historically courts have protected a right to assistance with one's suicide. But they don't look to the identity of the people who are seeking to exercise that right in order to see whether those people should be excluded from exercise of that right. Because otherwise, we know that Loving versus Virginia would have come out differently, or Turner versus Safley, because there was no historical right for prisoners to be able to marry, and the court didn't define the right at issue in those cases as the right to prisoner marriage or the right to marry someone of a different race.
Counsel, when you mentioned Glucksberg in your brief, and you make in your brief what for me is a very compelling argument as to why Louisiana should recognize a same-sex marriage from another jurisdiction. And in that connection, you talk about, you use the language from Glucksberg and how it's expected that it will be recognized throughout the land. And then you say that tradition is deeply rooted in history. And so in the category of we still win, would it be legally inconsistent to conclude that Louisiana should recognize same-sex marriages from other states, but at the same time conclude that Louisiana had a right to ban same-sex marriages in Louisiana?
I do think it would be, Your Honor, and two answers to that. First, I think the most instructive case on recognition of existing marriages from other states is, in fact, Loving versus Virginia. That was a case that involved a couple who entered into what's termed an evasive marriage, and that they lived in Virginia, they were not permitted to marry in Virginia, and then they went to Washington, D.C., they got married, and then they returned back to their home state. Virginia not only denied them respect for their marriage, but criminalized them for it, and the Supreme Court struck down that law because it infringed upon the fundamental right to marry itself. So that's the first answer. The second answer is that it would be inconsistent because the governmental interests that have been proffered by the state are the same, both for non-recognition and for denial affirmatively of the freedom to marry. And those governmental interests are legally insufficient, both of them, for both purposes. They bear no connection either to any legitimate governmental interest for denying recognition to people, and nor do they bear any rational connection to anything relating to preventing people from marrying in the first place. Turning to the equal protection argument a little bit, the heightened scrutiny test that the court has not applied in this jurisdiction but that other jurisdictions have applied. I mean, there are two factors that are routinely applied by courts, and then there are two factors that are sometimes applied but not always. We have all four present here. The state doesn't dispute that there's a lengthy history of discrimination against lesbian and gay persons in this country. What the state disputes is whether we have to show a history of disenfranchisement in order to meet that prong of the test. But disenfranchisement is not the test, and we know that because classifications, for example, based on illegitimacy, receive heightened scrutiny, even though there's no history of disenfranchisement there. The state also doesn't dispute the second prong, which is also one of the two more important factors, and that's the relationship to a person's ability to contribute to society. No one disputes that lesbian and gay people have an equal ability to contribute to society, and in fact, the plaintiffs in the Robichaud case exemplify this. The third factor the state does dispute, which is immutability, and this is something that courts have sometimes but not always considered. Immutability refers to whether it is necessary for a person to have to change their sexual orientation as a precondition to receiving government benefits or recognition. And not one of us, whether gay or straight, should be required to do that, because it's simply too central to our identity as human beings. And the American Psychological Association brief is also very clear that sexual orientation is immutable in the sense that it is incapable of being changed through active interventions, through therapy and so on. And in fact, the major mental health organizations of this country have come out saying it's harmful to try to change through those methods. So sexual orientation meets the test for that reason. And the fourth is relative lack of political power. The state disputes that we meet that prong as well. I think it's worth noting, not a single federal statute prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in employment or public accommodations, housing, credit. And in Louisiana, there is no statewide statute prohibiting discrimination on this basis either. When the Supreme Court decided that heightened scrutiny was appropriate for classifications based on sex, at that point we already had Title VII that prohibited discrimination on a federal level. So the level of protection that we enjoy through the legislative means is certainly less in the context of sexual orientation, and it seems very clear that lesbian and gay people are incapable of protecting themselves from discrimination in this way through the legislative process. The classification here is also sex discrimination. It is sex discrimination for two reasons. It discriminates based on sex as a facial matter because it expressly says that marriage is exclusively between a man and a woman and excludes Robert from marrying Garth because Robert is a man. And if Robert were a woman, Robert could marry Garth. It is also sex discrimination because it impermissibly enforces conformity with sex stereotypes in ways that the Supreme Court has already identified is not permitted. And the Price Waterhouse case, obviously, or the Bow Brothers decision are examples of sex stereotyping that's impermissible in different contexts. The JEB case, though, I think is the most important one to look at, because in that case, the court struck down the ability to challenge jurors based on their sex, even though that classification applied equally to men and women. And the court did so because it was impermissible to try to force people to conform to stereotypes about what their roles should be or how they should act, even if that stereotype was motivated by, for example, a desire to put women on a pedestal. It didn't matter. Those sex stereotypes may not be given effect by the Constitution. I'd also like to respond very briefly. The Sixth Circuit ruled just as we were putting in our reply brief, and we put in a response to some of the things that were mentioned in the Sixth Circuit opinion. Specifically, the Sixth Circuit decided that there was no infringement on the Constitution because it took an originalist interpretation of the Constitution. That is not an accurate description of our law. And we know that not only from the Planned Parenthood versus Casey quote that we provided in our brief, but also because of Lawrence itself and then Schuette. Schuette says that liberty's full extent and meaning may remain yet to be discovered and affirmed. We know that times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary and proper in fact serve only to oppress. As the Constitution endures, persons in every generation can invoke its principles in their own search for greater freedom. That's what the plaintiffs have done today, and we ask this court to reverse. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. You've saved time for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Duncan.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Same-sex marriage is a brand new perspective on marriage, one that only began to be considered in the last two decades by the states. The question here is whether the 14th Amendment compels states to adopt and recognize it.
Yes,
good
question.
Yes.
Let's suppose that I'm a 22-year-old male sentenced to life without parole, a prison system that does not allow conjugal visits. Do I have a constitutional right to marry?
Turner suggests that you do have a constitutional right to marry, Your Honor. Turner suggests that you probably have a constitutional right to marry, although Turner wasn't considering life sentence prisoners. It was considering prisoners who had the possibility of consummation of their marriages. I think the important point of that is that Turner deals with a limitation on marriage that is about incarceration.
Come back with a question. Does he have a constitutional right? Let's begin with your position as to whether they do or they do not.
Well, Turner suggests that a blanket ban on incarcerated persons being married violates the Due Process Clause. I think there are a couple of important points here. First of all, we know what the proper due process analysis is in a case called Glucksberg that comes after Turner and so puts that analysis in perspective.
Your analysis, by definition, he cannot procreate, can he?
Well, not under that hypothetical, right. And no one.
Why isn't that a complete answer to your, given the other arguments that you make? Why do you have to slice and dice Turner and go further with that?
Right, because Turner is dealing with incarceration, right? And so the proper due process analysis is to say, is the particular liberty interest asserted here deeply rooted in our national history? And a couple of things about that. First of all, the Windsor case specifically says that the man-woman aspect of marriage has been thought essential throughout history, and that the same-sex marriage view is a new perspective. So on that alone, it's impossible to see how that particular liberty interest properly described, as Windsor describes it, is a deeply rooted interest. The simple thing to say about Turner is it's dealing with incarceration. And so to draw an inference from that case, it says, therefore, same-sex marriage is deeply rooted, I think is a bridge.
Otherwise, I'm just suggesting that under your analysis, the simple fact that he cannot procreate should be a basis upon which the state could deprive him the opportunity to marry.
I don't think Turner stands for that proposition. I think what Turner is saying.
What I'm suggesting to you is you don't need Turner. You don't need the fact of incarceration. You just need a male who cannot procreate.
If I understand the point, Your Honor, what Turner is adding to the analysis is something about incarceration, right? And if we were going to put Turner in the proper Glucksberg analysis, we'd say that the inference you can draw from Turner is, yes, there has got to be some sort of deeply rooted right to marry despite incarceration. What the ultimate contours of that right are, we can't really say. I mean, because we have to be very careful in how we describe the asserted liberty interests. But I mean, take a look at Zablocki, for instance, which is another case in this line, which has to do with financial ability. I mean, so what Zablocki is doing is saying, look, there's got to be some kind of deeply rooted right to marry that has to be exercised independent of financial ability, right? I think that's a good inference we can draw from Zablocki. But what we can't draw from Zablocki is the idea that there's an undifferentiated right to marry that simply applies to, as the plaintiffs say in this case, and as they've just said to the court, that allows someone to marry the partner of their choice, full stop, right? Zablocki and Turner can't stand for that proposition, and Zablocki explains why. Because if there were such a broad, undifferentiated right to marry, it would call into question all of the state incidents and prerequisites of marriage. And we know, for example, that Windsor said states can validly differ on important matters like age, degree of consanguinity, and we could add to that list the duration of marriage, the number of partners, as Judge Sutton points out in the DeBoer case. So I think when we're talking about the due process right, the first step is to say, okay, what is the proper description of the liberty interest? And we submit that what plaintiffs are doing here is making precisely the same error that the Supreme Court reversed in Glucksberg. They're defining the liberty interest at such a high level of generality that you can't properly locate it within the national history. The Ninth Circuit in Glucksberg said, well, what you've got going on here is the right to die or the right to control the circumstances of one's death. And the court looked carefully and parsed its own precedents there and said, no, there is no such broadly stated liberty interest. What we have there is a very carefully cabined liberty interest, and the asserted interest there didn't fall within any deeply rooted interest. So the same analysis should apply here. We've got, just in 2013, we've got the Supreme Court saying same-sex marriage is a new perspective on marriage. The man-woman definition was thought essential until recent times by most people. This is Windsor saying this. So what does that mean? It means that the issue is to be left up to state democratic processes, and it is not a matter of substantive due process.
Well, there's other language, though, as you know, in Windsor that you have to deal with. For example, the statement that the differentiation demeans the couple whose moral and sexual choices the Constitution protects, citing Lawrence, and whose relationship the state has sought to dignify. That's pretty broad language regarding the specific choice that's involved here.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, Judge. What the court is saying in its Fifth Amendment holding is closely tied to state authority to recognize same-sex marriage. What Windsor is saying is this. When a state decides, in the exercise of its virtually exclusive authority in this area, to recognize same-sex marriage and to confer the benefits and the dignity of same-sex marriage on a couple, as New York did in 2011. When the state decides to do that, if the federal government seeks to override that choice and to say, nope, we're going to take away the benefits and the dignity that the state conferred, then the federal government has violated the Fifth Amendment. So the harm principle there is tied to the conferral of dignity by the state of New York. It's very clear in Windsor that the two parts of Windsor, the state authority part, is very extensive, and then the harm part are closely tied together. Notice, Windsor does not say DOMA Section 3 violates the fundamental right to same-sex marriage or the fundamental right to marry. Windsor does not say DOMA categorizes by sexual orientation and therefore violates the Equal Protection Clause. What Windsor says is very specific. It says that DOMA's purpose was to interfere with state sovereign choices about who may be married. That is a quote from Windsor. Consider it also from this angle. Windsor says that what is fundamental in this area is democratic decision-making. Windsor held up as a model New York's statewide deliberative process, in which Windsor said it allowed its citizens to weigh the benefits and the negatives of same-sex marriage, arguments for and against same-sex marriage. And what did Windsor say? Justice Kennedy wrote in that opinion that is a part of the dynamic of our state government and our federal system, is to allow that kind of democratic decision-making. And why? It's exactly what, because Windsor said about this novel understanding of marriage. It involves the community's consensus about the meaning of marriage and the direction of the evolution of equality.
Well, that statement is a little bit too broad, considering Loving versus Virginia. You have to deal with Loving.
So, and I don't want to, and I want to let you answer your, let me answer that question very quickly and then get to Judge Higginbotham. So, yes, obviously what Windsor says is that anything a state does is subject to constitutional guarantees, which the state has always recognized, right? So it's false what plaintiffs say, that we somehow say that democratic deliberation just overrides the Constitution. But what does Windsor say? Windsor says it must respect the constitutional rights of persons, and it cites Loving versus Virginia. When we go and read Loving versus Virginia, we find Loving versus Virginia says this. and this is a quote from Loving v. Virginia, there can be no doubt that restricting the freedom to marry solely because of racial classifications violates the central meaning of the Equal Protection Clause. We have a classification in Loving v. Virginia that violates the central meaning of the 14th Amendment. It is an invidious racial classification. It doesn't matter that it was applied equally to whites and blacks. It's an invidious racial discrimination. And so it is not surprising that Justice Kennedy would say, well, of course the states can't do what Virginia did in Loving.
Stay with your classification.
Sure.
For a moment. Let's assume that sexual orientation, I think, is an immutable characteristic. And it is not only an immutable characteristic, but there is no, it does not come with any disability. There's no suggestion that sexual orientation has any relevance to ability to perform itself, unlike retardation, for example, and that sort. So now you have a classifier of that order. What is the justification for using that as a classifier?
Right. So Cleburne addresses
what they're doing.
Cleburne addresses this, because that language that you're talking about the relevance to state classification is directly from Cleburne. So what Cleburne says is the state has the right to take into
standard. What do you point to? Is a rational support for the state to differentiate on that with that classifier?
Right, because the man-woman classification is directly relevant to the normal procreative potential of men and women. It's what Judge Feldman said, and it's also what Judge Sutton said. There's a very common sense link there. It's more than rational. It's a direct link.
Back to procreation, which is where we started. And the counter argument to that, of course, is, well, yes, if that really is the basis for it, Why is marriage not extended? Why is it open quickly extended to people who are sterile, or et cetera, or people of age, such as someone as old as I am, and hopefully could not procreate? And there's no question about that.
So to be clear, we're talking about two things, really. With respect to the procreation in turn, we're talking about fundamental right to marry. With respect to the question about the classification, we're simply talking about the link between the man-woman aspect of marriage and what possible state objectives. And we're saying that the natural results of procreation are that describe that link, right? But look, Judge, as far as the question about sterile people or infertile people, I don't think it's correct to say that marriage was somehow extended to those people. The definition of marriage has always been what it is, which is a man-woman definition.
We're talking about withholding marriage.
Well, I think we're not. I think we're talking about the basic definition of marriage that has always existed, which is what Loving said. What Windsor said, which is it has been thought essential. So it has been thought essential throughout history not to exclude gay people from marriage, and just as not to exclude people within the degrees of consanguinity or first cousin marriages or people outside the age range of marriage. It's not an exclusion, in other words.
We're talking about an immutable characteristic that does not relevant to performance. In terms of Cleburne,
yes.
You had the court, as Justice White walks through that, you are plainly the disabilities that accompany retardation are reachable for within the regulatory reach of the state, for obvious reasons. Correspondingly, what is the justification for the regulation which prohibit this type of marriage itself affirmatively, when it is based upon a classifier that is an immutable characteristic and has no relevance to performance? The argument goes that if you cannot articulate a basis for that, the inference of animus jumps at you. Not animus in the malevolent sense, but in the sense that it was described by counsel Lobsey.
Well, a number of things, Your Honor. First of all, Cleburne very clearly says the state can take distinguishing characteristics into account when it's relevant to the classification. not just to society in general, but to the particular objective. And here the objective has to do with procreation. And that shouldn't be surprising, because the link between man-woman marriage and the natural product of procreation is clear on the face of the law. That's why we've talked about all the
presumptions. Like Judge Posner said, that's ridiculous. That's his characterization of it.
Well, he's responding to a different kind of argument there. The argument we're making is much broader than the argument that Indiana made. Indiana was talking about accidental procreation, and we're not talking about that. We're talking about the basic link between the man-woman definition of marriage that Windsor said was essential throughout history and what possible purposes it could have. And those purposes are rooted, obviously, in biology. Take this as an example, Judge. The case we cite on page 57.
Counsel, help me understand how those purposes are frustrated if same-sex couples are allowed to marry. Right. How does that frustrate those purposes?
You know, I think what your question goes to, Judge, is there a harm to the institution caused by changing it?
Yes.
Fundamentally. And here is how I think Windsor deals with that question. Windsor says this is a foundational institution, and the man-woman part of it has always been thought essential. And so if the state wants to change it, some have and some haven't, then the citizens have to figure out, look, what are the possible ramifications here? They have to make predictive judgments about, well, what's going to happen if we do this? What's going to happen if we do that? The predictive judgments are future judgments. Very difficult to draw out exactly what may happen. But what Windsor says is that it's up to the democratic decision-making of those state citizens to do that. And here's an analogy. Not 6 months after Windsor, Justice Kennedy wrote Schuette. And that was about an equally divisive and difficult issue, affirmative action. And here's what he said about that. He said the citizens of a state can say, look, if we continue to have affirmative action in higher education, it may or may not lead to all sorts of difficulties, all sorts of predictive consequences. And it's up to the citizens of the state to figure out, do we want to bear those risks or do we want to have affirmative action? In other words, the predictive judgments
federalism, is that what we're talking about?
Well, in part, we're talking about that. We're talking about the Constitution allows the state citizens to make up their minds about difficult issues of social policy, especially where the predictive consequences of doing that are really unknown and unknowable.
But doesn't the court in Windsor say we do not rely on principles of federalism?
No, that's not what Windsor says. This is a very important question, Judge. So Windsor says we're not going to base the decision purely on federalism. And it was obvious why, because the federal government does have certain limited ability to define marriage, very limited, right? But what does Windsor say? It says state authority over marriage is of central relevance to the outcome. And why was that? Because the federal government departed from the usual tradition of deferring to state marriage definitions. And that created the unusual circumstance. That created the window into Cleburne, Judge Higginbotham. When the federal government did something so unusual, it did raise the issue of animus, right? And so state authority was central to that outcome. In other words, if states did not have the virtually exclusive authority to define marriage and including whether to adopt same-sex marriage, then there's no premise in Windsor for finding this unusual discrimination, right? That's why the court very clearly said what DOMA did was interfere with state sovereign choices about who may be married. It violated the rights of people to whom the state had already given the benefits of marriage, and therein lies the federalism or the state authority dimension of Windsor. So in other words, it's as Judge Sutton said in DeBoer, simply because Windsor didn't take the broad tack and say the federal government can never be involved in marriage, right? Windsor didn't say that because there are, you know, immigration, Social Security, there's certain narrow elements of marriage in federal policy. But what Windsor did is take the narrower route and say, look, when the federal government overrides a state choice about who may be married, then we've got unusual discrimination. Then we're in Cleburne, then we're in Romer territory, right, where you have an unusual law. So that's how state authority factors in here, and it's crucial. It's crucial. That's why when my friends on the other side, the plaintiffs started out by saying the state has flawed premises here. Well, with all due respect, the flawed premises that they identify are the very premises that Windsor based its opinion on. So state authority, Okay, Windsor said state authority is virtually exclusive over domestic relations law, and when the federal government seeks to override that determination, we have an unusual discrimination, which is why we have the inference of animus in Windsor that is just like Romer and just like Cleburne, right? So state authority is paramount in Windsor.
Yeah. Regulates marriage in all sorts of powerful ways. The tax structure, all these benefits that get conferred on marriage to further marriage, as you argue, et cetera, are federal acts.
Well, it's interstitial, Judge. That's discrete instances. That's what Justice Kennedy said in Windsor. It's very discrete. That's why he didn't say it's purely a federalism problem. But what he said is that the tradition of federal reliance on state definitions.
You can swallow it all, but it takes some pretty big bites.
Well, there's a reason, I think, that Windsor engaged in 7 pages and 16 paragraphs of discussion about state authority over marriage, right? And the reason is because it created the inference of unconstitutional discrimination.
My suggestion was a bit different. You're talking about the fear of what's being sought for here diminishes in some way the marriage, which is properly but highly valued system, and that the state is justified, the government is justified in furthering that interest by supplementing it, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just suggesting to you as an awful lot of that supplementation and support comes from the federal government, not the state government. State government charges a few fees here and there and whatever, but the tax burdens, et cetera. Look at Windsor. What the fight's over federal tax structures. That status, which is being defined in many ways and affected directly, it's federal regulation, isn't it?
No. The problem in Windsor was that the federal tax structure failed to defer to the state determination of marriage. That's the holding of Windsor.
I'm not talking about the specifics of Windsor in that instance. I'm talking about your argument that marriage belongs to the states. It has historically been belonging to the states. And it should be supported, and the states can do that. Well and good up to a point, but I'm just suggesting to you that is simply ignored the fact that the sustenance and the financial burden of it, much of that comes from the federal government. I thought that would be obvious. Maybe I'm just...
Judge, I mean, what I'm talking about, and I'm not sure if this is responsive to what you're saying, but there is a basic demarcation between state and federal authority over the definition of marriage that runs through Windsor, right? The federal government generally defers.
Who is married and who is the child? And those,
that's correct.
Those in the Social Security Act, the last time I looked, that's still a federal law.
That's correct. But what Windsor says is when the federal government has an unusual departure from deferring to the state marriage definition, then there's an unusual discrimination going on. And the whole premise of that is that the state gets to make the determination in the first place. I mean, look, if the state is not empowered to make this determination about marriage, it's impossible to figure out what Windsor's talking about, right? Windsor is talking about an unusual discrimination because the federal government didn't defer to the state definition. And in New York, it was to confer the benefits of marriage on same-sex couples. So getting to something that...
Well, you also have the pronouncement in Heller and other cases that under rational basis review, it doesn't have to be a perfect fit.
I mean, that's, exactly.
That's the point of having only that level of review, that there will be some who are advantaged and some disadvantaged by a law that otherwise has at least... past the low bar of some rational basis.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. I mean, rational basis means there doesn't have to be a perfect fit. So the idea that when the state classifies on the basis of man-woman marriage and it's looking towards the procreative potential of men-woman couples, it doesn't have to structure a system where if you don't want to have children or you're for some reason unable to have children, then you have to be excluded from marriage.
This goes, it seems to me, to Ms. Taylor's argument that the law is to be struck if it disadvantages or harms anyone, but I don't find any case law authority that says that.
Well, no, I don't think that works under rational basis, and quite frankly, that wouldn't even work under heightened scrutiny if you know, this court has already applied rational basis in this area. But it doesn't even work in heightened scrutiny because there the link has to be simply substantial, which is more than under rational basis. But here the man-woman definition of marriage is substantially related to the natural products of procreation of men and women. I think you need to look no further than the Nguyen case, Nguyen versus INS, which we cite on page 57 of our brief, which has to do with the federal government taking into account the basic biological realities of man-woman reproduction with respect to immigration law. You know, and there, if the government's able to do that, which it did in that case, and that case was even a gender differential case, here you have the genders being treated exactly the same, but the law is simply regulating on the basis of biological realities. There's nothing surprising about that, and as Judge Smith, as you say, the fit doesn't have to be perfect. It couldn't be perfect, I would add, without violating the constitutional right to privacy. So it's holding the state up to an impossible standard that has no application under rational basis, and it wouldn't even fail under heightened scrutiny. Just responding to what you said, Judge Graves, about what's the harm, this is another instance of the harm. It's asking the state to say, look, we're going to prove out in the future what are all the possible negative consequences of this, and we're going to have a marriage system that is sort of artificially and perfectly situated according to fertility. I mean, no state has ever had a marriage system like that. It's impossible. It's unworkable. And the reason we're even talking about it is because we're asking, why hasn't the state fundamentally changed its marriage system to accommodate this new evolving
system? So is your answer then that the fear of the harm is sufficient?
No, that's not what I'm saying, Judge. What I'm saying is that the harm to the institution, when citizens are sitting around in democratic deliberation and saying, should we change this fundamental bedrock social institution, right, that has served important governmental purposes from time immemorial, they're entitled to say, we don't really know what the circumstances. This is a very new, novel phenomenon. We have less than 10 years of data, and at the time this was put in the Constitution, 1 year of data, about
that's
what...
Not, and so since we don't know, we should fear the unknown, and therefore we should ban it.
That's not what I'm saying. First of all, we're not banning anything. We're deciding not to go the way of other states who are engaged in a novel social experiment. And the second thing is, it's not the fear of the unknown. It's saying, look, the man-woman part of marriage is a very basic, foundational part of the social institution. And we're being asked to take it out and to change the fundamental orientation of the institution. That's what Windsor said. Windsor said, when the citizens of New York, for example, when they got together in 2011 and said, should we do this or should we not, Justice Kennedy said, look, they did what state citizens do in our federal system. They had a statewide democratic process where they debated arguments against and for same-sex marriage, and they came out to, you know, their view of the thing. Now, it seems really implausible to say that when Justice Kennedy was writing that, he was thinking, now, if the citizens of New York decide to retain the definition of marriage, right, that they had up till 2011, if they decide to retain that, then they violated the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause. That doesn't seem to me to be a possible reading of Windsor. Instead, it's open to democratic deliberation, and if a state goes one way or a state goes the other way, that's the way that we approach this issue, especially an issue that is virtually exclusively given to the states to decide. I think that's the plain meaning of Windsor. And the reason that DOMA Section 3 violated the Constitution was because it overrode that state determination. And now here you have the plaintiffs, in so many cases, and in this case, who are saying, now we want the federal judiciary to override the state determination that the citizens made on marriage. That's just as much an interference with state sovereignty as DOMA Section 3 was. There the Congress was doing it. And here, the federal judiciary is being asked to do it. But the same principle ought to apply, which is that this is an issue, a novel issue, that is given to the citizens of the states to decide which direction are we going to go in. And so we ask the court to affirm Judge Feldman's decision upholding the democratic authority of the state to retain the longstanding definition of marriage.
All right, thank you, Mr. Duncan. Ms. Taylor, you save time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address first the suggestion that there might be some unknown harm from allowing same-sex couples to marry. There are now 36 states and the District of Columbia that allow same-sex couples to marry, and nothing has changed in those states except for the elimination of the gendered entry requirement to marriage. The state has argued here that the state can go one way or another through the democratic process, and they've suggested in their brief that it's wrong that the Bill of Rights should be construed as a one-way ratchet. But that's exactly what the Bill of Rights is. It's a one-way ratchet that allows states to legislate marriage subject to constitutional guarantees of liberty and equality. And to address specifically the suggestion that Windsor was decided exclusively on federalism principles, in Windsor, the court specifically said that state laws defining and regulating marriage must respect the constitutional rights of persons, and then it found it unnecessary to decide whether DOMA's federal intrusion on state power was a violation of the Constitution because the purpose and practical effect of DOMA was to impose a disadvantage, a separate status, and so a stigma, not only on the same-sex couples themselves, but on their children. The court wrote that DOMA was unconstitutional for reasons quite apart from principles of federalism, and I think we need to take the court at its word. To address Judge Higginbotham's question about whether procreation is an essential element of marriage, there are a number of courts that tell us what purposes, there are a number of cases that tell us what purposes marriage serves. And procreation, you know, certainly is something that many married couples do. But Turner versus Safley tells us that marriage serves other purposes for us as well, and we are allowed to chart these purposes for ourselves. Like, marriage can be an expression of emotional support and public commitment. For some, it's an exercise of religious faith or spiritual dedication. And of course, it's the precondition to receipt of a number of state benefits, but also, as Your Honor noted, a vast swath of federal benefits. And in fact, the state court in Garden State Equality, the New Jersey case that struck down New Jersey's marriage ban, specifically commented that the state was standing in the way of couples being able to access those benefits that flow from marriage. Windsor also acknowledges different purposes that marriage serves, like affirming our dignity and affirming our commitment to our friends and neighbors in their eyes and our community, and that it allows married couples to live in equal dignity with other members of the community. All of these are purposes that are equally important for same-sex couples as for different-sex couples. Moving to the state's procreative justification for marriage, the notion that procreation is a reason why marriage can be limited exclusively to different-sex couples, and their notion that linking children to their biological parents also is a purpose of marriage, that is actually a concession that marriage benefits children. And the state still has not explained why the children of lesbian and gay couples are any less deserving of those benefits and protections. This isn't just a matter of an exclusion that's slightly over-inclusive or under-inclusive. There is no connection whatsoever between the interests that have been put forward by the state and the classification that's at issue in this law.
Well, that gets back to the statement from Heller that I referred to. Heller's not the only one. The relationship can be based on what Heller called an imperfect fit between means and ends, talking about a rational basis, that, quote, results in some inequality. The argument about procreation and whether elderly couples are allowed to marry, that's a perfect example of an imperfect fit that results in some inequality, but Heller says that's fine, and the same point was made in this court's 2014 Planned Parenthood decision.
Well, Your Honor, as this court also noted in the St. Joseph Abbey case, a court is not required to accept.
There's a difference between imperfect fit and no fit.
That's correct, Your Honor, exactly. The court's not required to accept nonsensical explanations for a law. There must be a basis in fact or reality for the classification. And so if there's no logical connection whatsoever, then that law must fall. It's not a matter simply.
law, but that just frames the question of whether there, if there's no fit, which I essentially think the Seventh Circuit said, then you get one answer.
I agree, Your Honor.
I assumed you would.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Ms. Thank Taylor. Your case, which is the Louisiana case, is under submission, and we'll next hear the Mississippi case and then Texas, and we'll now take a recess.